This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 66, brought to you in association with Synchron, Archover and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to welcome Bob Jones, founder and CEO of Blue Motor Finance. After last week's super big picture tour de force about where policy and regulation come from, we go right to the opposite end of the spectrum to talk about how to build a profitable fintech in only 2 years. If the mega macro sets the context for how FS evolves over the decades, then it's equally true to say that FS is, at any given time, quotes, just, unquotes, a collection of companies. And of course, in terms of the current world of FS, old and new, there's nothing more exciting than to find a new startup, not just making waves, but actually doing that most old-fashioned of things, making a real profit. So Bob is here to give us all the secrets, though perhaps one ingredient most, or all of you, can't quite replicate is 50 years in an industry vertical. I think that might help. Now, in a world of PR and spin and hype and conferences and social media, what we all get to hear is a construct. Guy Debord's Society the Spectacle, written in 1968, presaged all this. Many people looking in on the fintech world confuse this constructed spectacle with the reality. We think the real players are the ones we read about all the time. However, far behind the spectacle and media construction, there are real companies just getting on with it. And surprise, surprise, a number of these are far, far more successful than all these thought leaders, influences, and so forth. I was asked last week for my recipe as an experienced podcaster by a chum who's opening an Iberian wolf sanctuary. Makes a change from opening coffee shops, eh? The main tip was to do it your own way, but my second point was spend as much time as possible sourcing the best ingredients. This latter point is one that is never over. It's like trying to find hidden gems. Anyway, this week we definitely have a hidden gem. My educated guess would be that this company is the most profitable true fintech in the whole of the UK. We'll talk about Blue Motor Finance anon, but some headline figures. To cut a long story short, essentially founded in 2014, with staff numbers of 12 at the time, they've now grown to 100, have lent over £200 million to date, and their profits are in the seven-figure mark. Core business is geared up to providing motor trade credit, which we'll come to later. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Morning, Bob. Thanks for joining me today.
Good to see you, Mike.
So we were talking last week and I struck lucky again. I struck lucky a while ago, actually, with one of the previous guests when totally out of the blue I mentioned Ronnie Reagan and he happened to have a story about having taken Ronnie Reagan to a pub in Baker Street. Anyway, we were chatting and for some reason, which now totally escapes me, I happened to mention the Beatles and you had a little story about being at the Beatles' first concert with Ringo. How did that happen and did you think they were any good at the time? Presumably Ringo couldn't drum then, as he couldn't drum much later either.
Well, somehow Ringo managed to persuade the Beatles that he was actually better than Pete Best. Yeah, I grew up in Liverpool and spent an awful lot of time in pubs and playing football, and we supported Everton. And incidentally, our current venture is called Blue Motor Finance as a reflection of the Everton colours.
Oh, wow. That's gone a long journey then, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I supported Aston Villa, but the podcast isn't Claret and Blue.
The trouble is, no matter how successful football teams are later, you have to stick with the first one, which creates ups and downs.
So what was this concert then? What year are we talking about now?
Oh, golly. 60-ish, about that.
Oh, right. So very early in the Beatles thing, before anybody had heard about them.
Yeah, I saw them play lots of times in the Cavern and a myriad of other clubs around Liverpool. But the claim to fame, if you like, was slightly bizarre in that they did a gig in support of a big band playing at the Port Sunlight Horticultural Society annual dinner dance. Heaven knows what they or me were doing there. Perhaps we were all planning to be gardeners. They were on the verge of mega stardom, and it was the first time Ringo joined them. It was the very first proper Beatles appearance, and I was there.
Were they any good? I mean, I've seen lots of bands that I like, and sometimes they're just terrible live.
I think that the production values in those days were not that good, and you can imagine them playing in what essentially was a village hall. So I don't go quite that far back with my memory, but I can't believe they were that good.
Talking of Liverpool bands, I was watching last week, it was on YouTube. Although strangely, I could actually watch this on my TV, but then I couldn't see it on the tablet later. Some funny thing about YouTube. a very interesting documentary about orchestral manoeuvres in the dark, who 2 or 3 decades later were very big in Liverpool as well and started being very small. And they were going around the club that they used to play at, which was opposite the Cavern Club and was now just some sort of, you know, semi-derelict basement. And for most people who weren't at the Port Sunlight gig in 1960, they'll probably see via the media, whether it's YouTube or television, all this stuff about bands of the 60s and the Cavern Club and all this kind of thing. And going back to what I was saying about society of a spectacle, for almost entire humanity these days, the Beatle and the Cavern Club is a spectacle created by the media, you know, and then you add your expectations onto it. But as somebody who was actually in the Cavern Club, what was it actually like compared to this sort of story which everyone puts together to later about inevitable success and it was all wonderful and, you know, yardy, yardy, yardy. Was it a bit of a dive as well as fun?
It was dirty. It was slightly damp. There's a terrible story that it had no true sanitation, but it was in a cheese warehouse with other cheese warehouses underneath.
Brilliant.
The suggestion was that the toilets vented straight into the place below. I think if somebody tried to run the Cavern today, most of the people associated it would get arrested. However, it's passed into myth.
Brilliant. Well, we definitely need to contact the historians of that period and make sure they add that bit in rather than this polished society of the spectacle. So from start, where you could have gone into the music business if only you'd signed them up there and then, you went in a different direction. And as I was mentioning earlier, I think one of your secrets is actually, you know, a lot about the business that you're in, which not every 20-something founding of fintech necessarily does. So what took you from gigs in the Beatles and supporting Everton to Blue Motor Group, very briefly, as you've done one or two things in the meantime?
Yeah, well, I joined Lombard, which was a relatively modest-sized and recently created motor finance company as a rep in Liverpool. And I did that not because I had a burning desire to get into the finance business, but the job came with a car. And so it's for that noble reason that I entered finance. Going on from there, my business career probably splits in two. I went on to work for Lombard for about 20 years, started as a rep, did the usual grand tour of the UK as a branch manager, area manager, and several other fairly meaningless titles. And eventually found myself on the main board of that company, which by now had grown to a 10, 11 billion pound asset operation. The thing that had probably the biggest influence on me, though, was that I was at some point sent to run a company called Tristy Finance, probably the biggest subsidiary of Lombard, and very much under the microscope of NatWest, who owned Lombard, because it was losing a lot of money.
Roughly which years we're talking now?
Around about 1990. They were probably losing about 2 million a month. And it had had the attention of various consultants trying to fix it. And I went there. I must have had a death wish to accept the job. But it was the first time I'd been confronted with being responsible for fixing a very large company.
And what kind of numbers of people are going up to very large? 100,000, 10,000?
They had about 1,350 people. And within about 4 or 5 months of my going there, that number was down to about 600. I don't take any pleasure in the fact that we made so many people redundant. I like to think of it as we preserved 600 jobs rather than lost 1,300. But we brought to bear on that a thing that we came to call available for costs. We'd worked out that you can change an awful lot of things about a company, but if your costs are out of control, then the rest of it all becomes a bit academic. And basically, available for costs, as the name suggests, you work out the size of the company, the returns people want, and at the bottom line is how much left you've got to run the company with. We applied that, and the only way that we could get an awful lot of cost out of the enterprise was to do a lot of the work through technology. And I suppose if it was around today, somebody would call it a fintech company, because we used technology in a way that not only eliminated a lot of cost, but it reduced the bad debt very significantly because we mechanized the whole underwriting function.
And you sort of modestly say that you use tech, but having been around myself in the early 90s, it wasn't that easy to use tech in the early 90s as it is now. It was a much larger achievement to actually make that work then. I mean, now that's one reason that fintechs, so many of them are blooming, is that tech is more approachable. There's more Lego blocks out there that you can just buy the Lego blocks and start sticking them together. In those days, you pretty much had to start sort of writing code yourself.
Well, that was pretty well what happened. I bumped into a Polish guy called Diz Janik, who built something in Oracle, I think it was. And it was very, very simple functionality. There were no clouds around. There were no special ways of holding your data. It was very simple, recording the name and address of somebody and zapping that information to a credit agency. Simple as that, really.
So your background was literally in the old-fashioned way, which is that from the ground upwards, you know, you understood all levels of the company. You then got to the stage where you successfully fixed, and I think it was more than, you know, one or two large organisations, and then you moved into the phase of, quotes, doing your own thing.
Yeah, one of the things that I found difficult to manage the more and more senior I became was there's an ethos in many banks of managing your career, not necessarily managing your job. And I really couldn't see myself fighting another 20 years of that particular battle. And I was approached by a guy called Chris Ward of Deloitte to see if I wanted to head up a management buy-in to a military finance company, which eventually became called Warrior. That all worked well. It was backed by NatWest and by HSBC. Having had some inkling of the power of technology, we brought to bear on that a team that was recruited with some IT skills, but very little knowledge of the business that they were coming into.
Which is pressing pause. It has a parallel with a number of fintechs these days. You've got some very clever IT people, but they don't particularly understand the business, and they slowly try and work out what the business is that they're in.
That's absolutely right. As it happens, our present Chief Technology Officer, Charlie Barker, who had that role at Wonga and various other places,
and has been a long-term supporter of the podcast, actually. And is so modest that he didn't mention he was working in a brilliant company until I put the thumbscrews on him.
Well, that company thrived in the building next door to the one we're sitting in now, and Charlie was part of that journey. And the technology we produced in support of Warrior is essentially created by the same people and is essentially a very, very, very improved version of what we use today. That was the basis of a launch into a mode of finance company that we created for Barclays.
So going back to vocabulary emerges and disappears, and there's always lots of press around, you know, what the latest words in the Oxford Dictionary are and all that kind of stuff. And in a sense, the fintech is just a word, and increasingly perhaps a bit of a silly word. But, you know, what we're talking about here is the fact that, in a sense, you were doing pretty much, quotes, the same thing in a prior incarnation 10, 20 years ago. And it's the same kind of theme continuing, just happening to use the different Lego blocks that are around. Charlie will be now using different Lego blocks than he was 10, 20 years ago, in terms of clouds and APIs and, you know, all these kind of words.
Yeah, and it was that knowledge that formed the basis of us using stuff that is unique, you know, using Amazon for functions that previously you would have had in-house, and you're getting the benefit of a vast organisation at a very, very cost-effective way. That simply wouldn't have occurred to people previously.
So as the CEO, clearly one of the things that you've been very successful at over a long time is standing on your surfboard at the edge of a wave of technology and leveraging that technology as somebody who really understands the business. And so marrying together these two components, which is business understanding. I mean, someone may not understand tech whatsoever, but they may really understand the business motor trade stuff. And vice versa, you may get tech people who really understand the tech. And presumably you're someone who's actually good at putting the square and the circle together.
Well, pretty well. Going back all those years to when I first got involved in this, what I have managed to bring to bear on this is an understanding of what the business imperative is, and have some relatively vague idea of how you can meet that imperative with technology. However, what's been absolutely fundamental to this is bumping into people like Charlie Barker and a team of like-minded people who could take the business ethic and turn it into a program, leaving us to get on with managing the nuts and bolts of the business proper.
Right, so that's clearly, I mean, coming back to this whole theme of building a profitable fintech, you know, in a sense, just forgetting the fintech word for the moment, in a sense, that's an equation which applies to a hell of a lot of businesses these days, which is if they understand the market they're in and they get a good team together and they get the tech working, then that's a really good and balanced grounding. And in terms of understanding the business that one's in, and increasingly, I think one comes back to sort of business principles for those fintechs that are getting somewhere. I was thinking back to LFP 059 with Will Wynn from Smart Pension, and in one of his incarnations, Arena Flowers, a friend of his had said to him that he's going to go into the flower business. And Will said to his friend, "Oh, that's crazy. You know, the flower business has been around for ages. It's completely sewn up and all that kind of stuff. And by the way, the flowers die after a couple of days anyway. You know, you've got to be crazy." So this guy went away and started making some money. Will thought, "Oh, well, if you can do that, I can do that." And 10 years later, Arena Flowers is still going and doing all the flowers for Moonpig. So from the outside, somebody might, like me, who knows very little about motor finance, might think, it's a market that's been around for ages. It's completely sewn up by the existing players. How on earth can I disrupt that? So as somebody who's inside a marketplace, how do you set about disrupting a market where there isn't a gap? Because a lot of the business school thinking, a lot of the MBA thinking is find a gap in the market, find something that nobody's doing and you know, go there. Well, that's sure, great. It's like, you know, in the old days, find some white space on the map and go and put your flag there and say, oh, this is my country now. But actually, in a lot of the economy these days, it's there already. I mean, before Blue Motor Finance existed, motor finance had been around for a while. So what's different about it disrupting an existing marketplace, which is going on perfectly happily without you?
There is no doubt that we are not discovering a cure for cancer here. We're not doing something that is wholly and totally unique. There are some unique aspects of it, and there is an element of doing it better, smarter, faster, which is a hackneyed old phrase, but it has got a relevance here, and perhaps I could give you some background to why. There are £88 billion worth of car sales in the UK in a year. Of that £88 billion, £25 billion is credit arranged at point of sale, which is the business we're in. Now, the interesting figure is the difference between 25 and 88.
About 63 off the top of my head.
I'm not very good at numbers.
I was wondering why 63 was interesting, but anyway, carry on.
Well, it means that there are an awful lot of people buy cars and don't arrange credit at point of sale. So you're really seeking, A, to expand the market, to get more out of that stuff that isn't arranged at point of sale, but you are also looking to do better, some simple things. And probably the three things I would guess that would have most impact on what we're doing is a very, very sound team of people who have been around for a long time, who enjoy the excitement and live in an ego-free zone. We've got a lot better at finding finance, had some bruises along the way that caused us to rethink some of our strategies in that, and that's what has made it very robust. And dear old technology all over again. In terms of cost management, provision of a service, and very important in our business, lending carefully and sensibly.
Yes, I mean, picking out some of those themes, I mean, talking to Charlie and one of your other colleagues before, I think one of the strands that we'd drawn out, because people often kind of underestimate their talents, but one of the key things in FS as a whole, of course, is credibility and trust. And clearly, one of the things you've got as somebody with a long history in the marketplace is credibility and trust. And that's important, not just from a customer perspective, but also coming back to the team point in recruiting a good team. So, for example, if I set up a fintech tomorrow to disrupt the motor finance business, it would be very unlikely that I would be able to get someone like Charlie to do my technology and, you know, your head of sales to do my head of sales and all that kind of thing. So in terms, I think, of the recipe for success, it's very easy to neglect when someone really knows what they're doing, how important that is to magnetise people coming in your direction. And again, a lot of the fintechs that have just sort of been created, as it were, out of thin air, are started by people without much depth in an area. And I'm thinking of one or two in particular, where they say to me off the record, oh, we started with a good team, Mike, but actually then we got a bit of success, and actually we got a better team, and actually, you know, now we're getting an even better team as well. So a lot of people from a standing start, it takes them a long period of time to generate enough credibility in an area to start attracting the cream of the crop.
I would say that's absolutely right. Where I've been fortunate is that over the years, I've bumped into people who are really good at what they do. One of the people we've got here is my son. I've known him quite a long while. And the whole of the management team, of whom I would say there are really five or six key ingredients, were either known to us before we relaunched Blue or were known to people we knew. So we've got nobody here that's been brought in cold. We've had a direct relationship with them. We've worked together. We've created businesses together a lot more than we've managed to talk about here today. And they all work together and trust each other.
So that's an important point here. When we were talking on the phone last week, we were talking about some of the secrets of success, and we were both concerned about the fact that it could end up just being sort of motherhood and apple pie, you know, have good tech, have a good team, have a good business. Well, it's kind of sort of circular, really, and it's very much the same as saying, well, go to the gym, eat your cabbage, go to bed early, and don't drink too much. I mean, it's all very good advice, but maybe if everybody tries it, they don't get the same result. And just wearing a risk hat, what you're talking about here, and again, I've seen it operate in a different way elsewhere, is reducing your risk on the team. If you've known them for decades, if you worked with them 20 years ago, and if they're all known to people you know, then the recruitment risk, shall we call it, is relatively low. And it's not a diversion you go down for a few years finding actually that somebody isn't as good as they say and all that kind of thing. And it's a different story for a different time. Maybe I'll tell it in my New Year special, wrapping up last year and talking about next year. But in terms of the process that I went through when I was getting the sponsorship for the podcast in the summer, without telling tales out of school, I spoke to a number of people, not too many companies actually, but I spoke to a number of people. And it was just clear to me that some companies just aren't recruiting good people. Now that's life, that happens. But if you recruit the wrong people, it can actually take a long time to get you back on track. So again, one of the things that for people listening, you know, if you can reduce your recruitment risk and get the right people up the front, that really shortens the journey to profitability as well.
Well, it does. And if you step outside of the core management team here, you said earlier that we'd move from 12 people to 100 in a couple of years. We positioned ourselves, geographically positioned ourselves, near to Sevenoaks. Very, very important rail hub. It's got three stations that go into town. Why is that important? Because we've recruited a lot of people here who...
I got fed up of commuting on Southern Rail into London.
That's exactly right.
Well, if you want a receptionist, I'm up for it, because I've had enough of Southern Rail commuting this year. I don't have the kind of legs for it, but actually not allowed to say that anymore because it's not PC, but maybe we're moving past the PC world. Anyway, actually, on this point, actually, and again, just comparison with Smart Pension, we are just outside the M25 for those people abroad listening to the show. I'm very pleased to say we're only about half an hour's drive from my house, so I had a lovely drive and a beautiful Sunday morning round here. And again, Smart Pension in Hammersmith, although now in Paddington, and you guys at Sevenoaks, these are businesses in, you know, unsexy areas compared to all this sort of level 39 and Canary Wharf and, you know, PRE hype you see. And I think this comes back to a couple of things, which is firstly, as you said at the beginning, that every business needs to have a good control of their costs, because otherwise you cripple yourself. And I see far too many fintechs starting in sexy, fancy addresses, which cost them quite a lot. And that just puts the profitability down the curve. And then secondly, you know, going back to offering a different proposition. Obviously, people think about that in terms of offering a different proposition to the customers, better, smarter, faster, cheaper, whatever. But actually, offering that to the staff is a good deal. And joking apart, people can get fed up over the years of sort of, you know, an hour and a half commute each way. And if you're offering them sort of 10 minutes down the road, then that really helps enormously, doesn't it?
It does. And it has meant that we've been able to pick and choose a little bit over the people we recruit. And we've got an interesting, I think, spin on interviewing people. We interview them in the initial stage, and then we let them go around the business, talk to their erstwhile colleagues, and in a sense, they're interviewing us. And it's, do we come together with a meeting of minds?
Yes.
And that sounds corny, but it's actually very powerful. And we end up with people with an empathy with each other almost before they even join us. And that's been very, very good for us.
Talking about sort of grey hair and no hair, I'm doing better on the no hair stakes. You're doing better on the grey hair stakes. But as I often sort of use an un-PC analogy, but in terms of relationships, and it's a relationship in the work. You've got a relationship with your colleagues, you've got a relationship with the company and all these kind of stuff. It's a bit like when you're a 17-year-old boy, if there's a pretty girl in the party, she smiles at you. That ticks all the boxes, that'll do.
Yeah, never happened to me. But yeah.
No, I know, exactly. It's just my sort of fantasies looking back. I wish it had happened, actually. Most of them sort of frowned and ran away. That's another story for another day. But as decades go by and relationships go by, what you realise is more important than just somebody who happened to smile at you, and they're probably smiling at someone over your shoulder anyway, is actually, in terms of Venn diagrams, is an overlap of the circles. It's people going in a similar direction, wanting the similar things. You know, it's this matching process in terms of getting jobs or in terms of romantic relationships or in terms of the business you've got on the client basis. And so any process that you can go through, kind of a dating process in a sense you're talking about, where both sides get to know each other as long as you haven't got one side that's sort of desperate and isn't sort of, you know, lowering their criteria, then you end up with people, I assume, joining. You think, oh, these guys get 8 out of 10 at my school. That's just the people I'm after.
One of the very important conditions we put on our field force, and we've gone from not having a field force to having 40 people on the road, and each of them were recruited because they could demonstrate that they could hit the ground running. That is, they had existing relationships. And we were able to go from virtually no relationships to having something like 1,500 or 1,600 dealerships who introduced business to us. Now, the policy of letting them interview us as much as us interviewing them was a very powerful one, because we have taken all of our salespeople from existing jobs in major recognizable motor finance companies. That's very unusual for them to come into a new organization.
Absolutely. And I think this, you know, again, this is another point which really strikes home with me, and thinking about how Smart Pension went from zero to 120,000 clients in 2 years in auto enrollment pensions. One of the things that stood out in that podcast was the extent to which they'd used old school channels, you know, direct marketing, email, having a sales force out there, having people wearing out the shoe leather. And again, there's one type of tech firm, and this is a valid model, you know, and sometimes this works really well. There's one kind of tech firm out there, in the broader sense, that literally just sort of lives in computers and in phones. And those kind of things can work quite nicely. I mean, you know, WhatsApp has done really well out of it, and Snapchat and all these kind of things. It doesn't really exist out there. But for many businesses and for large chunks of fintech, and some have found this out the hard way, before we're born, there is an economy out there. There are millions, there are tens of millions of people interacting with networks and relationships and all that kind of stuff. And if you do a little startup, whether it's a tech startup or just an FS startup, you can live in your own world and try and create things in your own way. And plenty have done that, and some have been slightly successful. But it seems to me that the commonality of the rare firms like yours that I meet that are really successful, one of the essential ingredients of what they've done is plug into this vast network of kind of, you call it microeconomics and human relationships that's out there. Vast, vast network. Vast network. If you plug into that, as you say, with your sales force, and, you know, getting to sort of 1,500 plus dealerships pretty rapidly is amazing, then you've got the best of both worlds. You've got the sort of sexy, techie, mobile phone in your pockety world going, but also you're plugged into the real world, and especially in the context of motor finance, it is a very real world, because motor cars are made of sort of metal and steel, and they're quite heavy. There's real things out there. It's not just abstract things like, you know, sending messages on WhatsApp or something.
Yeah, you mentioned a second ago people leveraging existing relationships is, I guess, a different way of putting part of what you just said. We're in an environment here where, and we shouldn't diminish the quality of the other companies in this world. Three in particular, Barclaycard, who, not surprisingly, we've got a regard for because we started it, Motonovo, and Black Horse, the biggest of all. These are very high quality organizations, and we have got to be very light on our feet, and I believe we've used technology better than they have. That's not to say what they do is awful, but I would say what we do is better. And of course, once you've got on a roll, and we over the years have managed to stay a little bit ahead of the game in terms of the quality of our technology in each of its iterations, going back 20 years now, and that's what we're striving to do now. We are in the process of taking out all of our IT systems, and we are working now on recreating those systems in a more modern idiom, things that you know better than anybody, how quickly the functionality in IT changes. And one of the things that has been very, very important to us is staying ahead of the pack as far as technology is concerned, and using technology to continue to give yourself that edge in an environment that is populated by talented players.
Absolutely. So in a sense, you're applying the principle of creative destruction to your own organization. You're like a steam train going along, and you're trying to upgrade to diesel as you're chuffing along the tracks. And that's a very interesting point, because again, one doesn't read enough about it. One reads plenty of stuff about, oh, all these new fintechs and that, they've got great technology. Well, yes, but technology, as you say, changes amazingly rapidly. So one thing that springs to my mind, for example, which I don't think I've seen covered in the press, is that one of the reasons, especially as I understand for the larger, older peer-to-peers, that they haven't been regulated by the FCA at the moment, is certain things around client money, which we don't need to go into. But one of the challenges is that although these new hot, sexy, blah, 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 peer-to-peers and fintechs are at the leading edge of technology, blah, 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 their technology is now perhaps 5 or in some cases over a decade years old, which means it's out of date. Not just it's necessarily out of date in a tech sense, but it had a certain design ethos, particularly around the client money, which it then turns out that actually, oh, you know, a regulator then appears 5 or 10 years later, wants a bunch of stuff. And do you know what? Nobody thought of that when you were designing it. And, well, it's a bit hard to do that. So they actually then have to start doing their own tech all over again. In this case, sort of pushed on them by the regulator. So again, you know, I like your ethos that you want to be ongoingly trying to sort of beat yourself all the time.
Well, yeah, it's a kind of, in this business, everything's new and nothing's new. We go back the 20 years we talked about earlier from when I was fixing Tricity. There were two philosophies there. One was what I said, available for costs. Make sure your costs can be covered by the rest of the business. But the other thing we didn't talk about was a thing called Project Greenfields. And Project Greenfields is that every 2 years, say, and we're doing this right now, you look at your business and you say, if I was starting this business today, what would it look like? And the comment I made a few minutes ago about us not exactly junking our existing systems, but certainly having an approach that reflects the now is part of that challenge process. If you came back in 2 years' time, if you've recovered from the boredom by then, you may very well see a different company operating. There will be a lot of residual efforts on the normal operational side, but I would hope it would look very much newer from a technology point of view.
Yes, as you say, things stay the same and things change. Plus de chance, plus de même chose. But I think the things is that the details are always changing. But again, you know, coming back to some of the principles you're articulating clearly here, is the principle that you've been operating for some time, is this need to continually upgrade? I mean, today's leading edge technology is tomorrow's legacy technology. And the world is always changing. And, you know, however good you are today, and then tomorrow or the day after, actually, there'll be a slight mismatch.
Yeah, an area that we perhaps haven't dwelt on at all here, but which is as important as everything else this and other lending relation institutions get involved in, and that's regulation. If we had to satisfy the data required by the regulators, the activities required by the regulators, and try to do that manually, then that alone would kill us. So again, technology ensures that you can have an economic relationship with, in our case, the FCA.
Yes, I mean, I think we flogged to death the macro regulation point in the last episode with Lord Turner, and I certainly like his takeaway, using his language, that micro supervision isn't the right way forward in terms of regulation. We need, you know, simpler, bigger picture rules, but it may be a little while before the world gets that in terms of regulation. So there's a lot of points of wisdom in there, Bob, and I'll draw them out in a perhaps more linear fashion in the show notes for people that want to check them out. But I think that, like one or two or maybe three or four tops podcasts I've done the last 2 odd years that are really covering wisdom, a number of these things may sound self-evident, but wisdom is generally about being very simple and about applying principles well. And I think it repays any amount of thinking. I mean, you know, if you're still doing this business or a different business in 10 years' time, you'll be applying some of these principles in a slightly different way. Anyway, so before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all my listeners out there. I appreciate every one of you, and I liked hearing your feedback. And I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, smart, simple, and transparent P2P business lending. Loans to £3 million for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure, and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. And Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 6,000 people, 16 countries, and $400 million of revenue. So, just wrapping up, Bob, with the dessert course, I mean, we've spoken about Blue Motor Finance implicitly in a number of things that you're doing, but I think more we've really focused on the sort of themes of how you've been doing things over the decades, very successfully in huge companies or in small companies. In terms of wrapping up now and waving sort of two or three flags about what you're up to at the moment and where you're going in the future, and if any of our listeners have got relevance to you guys.
The dilemma in answering that question is we're in a very mundane business, really, that's made exciting, I guess, and this is such a boring phrase, but through technology. I think that one of the great benefits of dealing with venture capitalists, and there can be downsides to that as well, but one of the great benefits is you never lose focus about what you're here to do. And if you were inclined to lose focus yourself, believe me,
they'll prevent
that from happening. And the focus is simple. You're here to create profit and you're here to create value. Blue hasn't and won't lose sight of that.
So your VCs are clearly very lucky, Bob, because they've got somebody who is focused on profit. And although you say VCs never lose sight of that, a number of the VCs for a number of years, although I think they're all slightly changing at the moment, have been focusing much more on land grab. How big a company can you grow? And I'm sure we'll grow a way out of this profitability problem. And just realizing in 2016 that you don't always grow your way out of a profitability problem. In fact, you can grow your way into a bigger hole as time goes by. So in terms of you guys having been incredibly successful, as I say, I think it's no false modesty. I think it's just an accurate comment that you're by far the most profitable fintech I've come across. You're somebody who's got a history of doing a huge number of successful things in a vertical they've stuck to. But life can always be better in the future. Life can always be better next year. In terms of what you'd like more of from Father Christmas, who's going to come in a couple of weeks' time, for 2017 for Blue Motor Finance, what kind of things would you want more of?
One of the things that the early Blue told me was it was about eggs and baskets. We had a single source of funding through Merrill Lynch. We knew that nothing could happen to an organization of that size, didn't we? Unfortunately, we discovered the hard way that having one source of funding is not clever. So we are speaking and would wish to speak to more people who would be potential funders of our type of business. And there are other directions in which we intend to take this business, and a conversation on other areas of related activity would be good to have with people who are interested in what is in effect installment credit. You can never have enough introducers, and although we're building a middle market stance with relatively modest sized dealer introducers, we are interested in doing business with major dealer groups, the Pendragons and Arnold Clarks of this world. And of course, we're here to be sold, and that is either a complete sale or possible partial investment. And we would obviously be interested to maintain a dialogue with people who've got that appetite.
Excellent. Well, if amongst about 4,000 people that are probably going to listen to this, there are any people with sort of plenty of money in their pockets, then they can come and help you on all of those angles. But I'd like to thank you today, Bob, for sharing your experience here. And I think what I've particularly got out of this is the way that you have these principles which you've used a number of times. And if you relentlessly apply in a rigorous fashion these principles, it really does tilt the dice in your favour. It puts more sixes on the dice, as it were, and makes it more likely you're going to be successful than not. As always in life, there's always a lot of fortune and fate in it, and skill as well. So I think that no doubt you're being very modest and underestimating your own skill and contribution and leadership, which you haven't mentioned, but that's going to be a key part of it. From what you say, there's a very big market out there, so I don't think you're going to run out of market capacity. If there's £25 billion of credit already done and another 63 missing, then it'll keep you busy for some time expanding in the future. And I wish you and Blue Motor Finance every success. So thank you for that, Bob.
Very kind. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. We'll be right back. are wild, like the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.